Hey, folks. Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
I can't lose a mom.
I know, honey.
It's so hard.
Oh.
I'll never make it through this.
Yes, you will. We all will.
I mean, with Patrick, it was so sudden. You know, I didn't even have time to react. You know, I just... moving forward because of the boys. You know, I mean, I've always been the one who tells everyone else to be strong and have faith. Look at me, I'm a mess.
Honey, you're the strongest person I know. And you're a great mom. You're not alone, dear. God has never left you, and he never will.
Yeah, I know. Stay strong, Maddie. Trust God, Maddie. Whatever his will, Maddie. Well, you know what? I don't agree with his will, Mom. I have a little boy in there who's dying. Do you think he cares about God's will?
Well, he seems to. He writes letters to him every day.
I don't want to hear that, okay? I don't think God cares about any of this.
Ever been angry at God because of what he's allowed to happen in your life? Ever wonder how some people make it through catastrophic loss? Not only make it through, but go on to a deeper, more intimate relationship with God. All loss is difficult, but there's perhaps no loss greater than that of losing a child. Add the loss of a mom, cancer, and sexual abuse to the mix, and grief becomes compounded. Teresa Sowers experienced all those losses and has endured incredible suffering. Today, she's here to share her compelling story of loss and redemption. Teresa, welcome to Heartline.
Hi, Rita. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yours is a powerful story of suffering and redemption. Can you start us out by taking us on your journey through loss? Where did it all begin for you?
My first real experience with loss came when my mother died. She was 42 at the time. She died in a car accident, and I was 22 years old. That was my first up-close and personal experience with loss. Following her death came a couple of miscarriages, which were very hurtful and certainly a loss. My most traumatic experience with grief and loss would be the death of our son, Nathan. He died when he was 6, resulting from complications after a kidney transplant. I have also have a different kind of grief coming from childhood sexual abuse, having been sexually abused by my grandfather, and then yet an even different kind of grief coming with being a breast cancer survivor a couple of years ago. So all of them components of grief, very different experiences, but nevertheless still grief.
Yeah, obviously losing a mom at that young of an age. I lost my mom fairly young too, and that's really hard for a young woman. How did you process that loss? I know we've talked about you having this emotional shutdown. Were you able to grieve that loss?
I did not. I did not have the skills or tools that I needed to even begin to know how to grieve a loss. And being the oldest of four children, and plus my dad still left behind, I threw myself into taking care of everybody else. Threw myself into, at the time I was going to school, I was working, newly married, so I had a lot of things to throw myself into in order to stay busy and to avoid dealing with the loss of my mom.
So then the illness and death of your son, the bottom drops out on that. Can you talk about,
absolutely.
You can talk about how his diagnosis and subsequent illness affected your heart.
Okay. Nathan, we went in for a routine ultrasound at 20 weeks of pregnancy, and we were, our biggest decision of the day was whether to ask if it were a boy or a girl. And when they began to tell us that our baby had a urinary blockage, which was preventing, we found out that we were having a little boy, was preventing him from creating the amniotic fluid that he needed to develop in and to develop his lungs with. At first, it can't be true. There's some kind of a mistake, that denial again. And then the reality sets in, and we eventually, 2 weeks later, we had in utero surgery in an attempt to save his life. Should have, they anticipated that he would have brain damage, handicapping conditions, and certainly had extensive damage to his urinary system. And miraculously, the only problem that Nathan had, although it was significant, was urinary related. He was not brain damaged or handicapped. And so you're on a roller coaster ride of, you know, 1 minute you've bottomed out, finding out that your unborn baby could die. And then you're elated because an experimental procedure, surgery in utero, works and literally saves his life. And then you bottom out when he's born and you find out that he's got significant health issues. So you're on an emotional roller coaster with your heart.
Yeah, the whole time.
Yeah, I didn't do well dealing with emotion. And so I did a fair job at stuffing a lot of the emotion through the... After Nathan was born, my life became very much centered around him and his health, and he had lots of surgeries and procedures, and we were always monitoring him medically. He was in the hospital a lot, and when he was, I was there with him. So I didn't have time, really, for a lot of dealing with emotion and grief that came with that.
You walled off your heart to that and just stayed focused on the task at hand, was doing, taking
exactly.
care of. Yeah. So what would people who knew you before Nathan died have seen? Did they know you were struggling, or did you come across like you had it all together?
No, I had the false assumption that if you had a strong faith, you know, if you were relying on God and prayer, I had the false assumption that you couldn't struggle, and you shouldn't show that you were having a hard time. Somehow I equated having a hard time and having doubts and having emotional breakdown, somehow I equated that with weakness and lack of faith. And so if I did break down, it was rare in public. And if I did, it was privately at night after everyone had gone to bed. People saw a very capable, and even we would remark, I don't know how you do what you do. I don't know how I did what I did. By the grace of God, I did it. But I gave a very different view to those around me than what was actually going on in my heart and in my private life.
So you have this hard heart, and we know our hearts don't get calloused overnight. It's often the result of the messages we receive earlier on in childhood. So where did that start for you? You obviously had to have gotten the message that, like you said, it wasn't okay to feel or show emotions or any of that. So you developed this core relational belief system, a way of relating to people that said, I've got to be strong, I've got to be tough, I can't show emotions. Did you get those messages from mom or dad, or where did that start for you?
I got it from the environment that I lived in, and certainly, you know, parents and extended family played a part in that. The church that I grew up in played a part in that. But, you know, just from the environment in general, did not live in an environment where I was taught or had modeled how to deal with emotion. Grew up, you know, believing that anger itself was a sin. So I was not allowed, you know, to express a lot of emotion. And then being sexually abused as a small child for a number of years, that wound to your heart, to your soul, that significantly shut me down. I didn't know what to do with that hurt. And so at a very early age, began stuffing and walling off my heart and at some point vowing, you know, I will never be hurt again. And in order to do that, you shut down emotionally.
Absolutely. People need to know that the normal response to suffering, loss, is grief, and that it's okay to show it and to express it. We buy into so many of these trite cliches of grief that say your loved one wouldn't want you to be sad, or all things work together for good, or just a number of things that shut us down in our response to grief. Did anybody throw those at you? I mean, people are notorious as well for throwing Bible verses at us, and not that that's bad. I mean, we need scripture, but I think people need to be sensitive as to when we throw out a Bible verse.
Yes, I believe that to be true. Yes. I had a number of people that tried, you know, those cliches or to put a spiritual Band-Aid on a gaping wound. And I don't think that for the most part people mean ill when they do that.
No.
I don't think they do, but neither do I think they understand. I think the big problem is that people try to put those emotional Band-Aids on for us because if they're uncomfortable with our emotion, they're uncomfortable with our grieving, and the more significant it is, the more it scares them, because if they can't offer a Band-Aid to me that somehow alleviates or relieves the pain, then what on earth are they going to do when it's their turn? And I think there comes a fear with that.
Sure.
So sure, they try, but those things just, if anything, they irritated me and stirred it up even more. I didn't want to hear. Even Bible verses, I know that sounds sad, but even Bible verses I didn't want to hear, that all things work together for good. I was not in a place to receive that.
No, it's great until it's your trial or your suffering or your child that dies. Exactly. So I think people are uncomfortable with our grief, and I think they don't know what to say. And so they avoid or they say the wrong things. I had that happen to me numerous times through the loss of my mom and my dad. And it's probably better to say nothing. So what do you need? What does the griever need in those times? What did you need from people?
The thing that worked best for me was when someone came and just would sit with me. Someone would allow me to be and feel and express whatever it was that I was feeling and experiencing in the moment. If I was angry, they let me be angry. If I was sad, they let me be sad. If I didn't want to talk, they didn't make me talk. Taking care of practical things, you know, like meals or laundry or whatever, that's wonderful because you're not even in a state to even think about those things needing to be done, much less to do them. But as far as dealing with the grief itself, the best thing a person can do is just offer their presence. Say, you know, I'm so sorry. Say, I don't know how you feel. But beyond that, just to sit with a person and let them be however they need to be is the best gift that a person can give to someone who's grieving.
And I think people need to learn to ask for what they need. I think so oftentimes we don't do that, and as the grievers, we don't do that.
Mm-mm. No, we don't.
Okay, so how about anger at God? You've obviously had to have gone through times when you were angry, raging about God. And I think as Christians, as you said a little while ago, a lot of us think that it's not okay for us to be angry at God. Can you talk about that?
Sure. As I said, you know, I grew up believing that anger itself was a sin. And so for me to be angry at God, well, that would be the ultimate sin. And my anger at God started before Nathan died. He had a surgery where he almost died, and but didn't. And I came back from that surgery, and I was livid. And I was seeing a pastoral counselor that we had on staff of our church, and he helped me to identify what was going on with me, and what was going on was I was mad at God. And it took me a while to be able to state that, and to acknowledge that I was indeed mad at God. I was really just ticked off at God. And so I worked through some of that and began to get comfortable with expressing how I was really feeling. He knows anyway. God knows how I'm feeling anyway. And then, of course, after Nathan died, that anger hit an all-time. It was off the charts. I knew that God is all-powerful, and he could so much have fought Nathan's healing, even as they were unhooking him from life support. He could have fought it, and Nathan would have gotten up and been fine. And God didn't do that. I mean, we had people praying, we had people fasting. God didn't do that. Mm. And I'm furious. How could you not heal a little boy? How could you not do that?
How did your anger come out?
My anger came out verbally, sometimes in a counseling session, sometimes in a grief group setting. Much of my anger came out in the form of journaling. My journaling, God laid it on my heart to begin journaling when I was pregnant with Nathan, and I continued with that up until today. I still journal. And that was my biggest outlet, because in my journaling, I could say things that I would never even say to a counselor. That was very therapeutic. And of course, in prayer, I got to a place where I am very comfortable being verbally expressive in prayer to God as to how I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. And again, he knows anyway.
Absolutely.
And I think there's something that happens when I acknowledge it before him. Then he can do something with it.
How about anger itself? Regrets?
Yes, I have had a number of times, especially with Nathan and his illness, because I was his caretaker. There were times that I held myself accountable, responsible for things that would go wrong. And for example, there was a time Nathan had a simple cold, and I, by the pediatrician's advice, gave Nathan some Advil and Benadryl to help with the cold symptoms. And those two drugs in combination are a very big no-no for someone who has renal problems. And it sent Nathan to the point that he was almost in renal failure and was about ready to need to start dialysis. I cannot tell you the guilt, being mad at myself. How could I? Well, I didn't know. I didn't know. And certainly after he died, wrestled with my responsibility and being mad at myself, that I should have expressed more clearly to the doctors that he had problems with sedation and narcotics in the past with pain, and that maybe I didn't help him to understand the significance of that, or maybe I should have fought the decision to have transplant at all. I did a really good job with myself with that mother guilt.
Sure, it's all that unfinished business, well, if only I'd done this, and if only I'd have done that, or what if this, or what if that. Sure. How did you forgive yourself? What was that a process for you? Was it another decision that you made that I'm just not going to carry this for one more day?
The biggest thing for me was speaking truth into those things. You know, I am not a medical doctor. So, you know, I did not know that combination of drugs could send a child into renal failure, those kinds of things. But I think the biggest thing for me was recognizing that God was big enough, is big enough, that if I were to have been responsible, that he could have countered that. For example, if I had made the decision for transplant and that was the wrong decision, God would have been a big enough God that he could have intervened. But the thing is that God is sovereign, and Nathan's his life was meant to be 6.5 years here on earth, whether I like that or not. That was God's decision. And my decisions can't come up against his sovereignty. It does not override his sovereignty in my son's life.
So acceptance is a huge piece of this. Acceptance and then acknowledging the sovereignty of God. That's exactly the two things that I wrote about in my book. And then trust. We have to trust the heart of God even when bad things happen. It's easy to trust God when the story has a happy ending. But when the bottom drops out, can I still look up and say, God, you are good? Okay, so before Nathan's illness, you knew God. You had a relationship with him. But after the suffering and all this loss, how did your relationship with him change? What's different today about you and God?
I had a minimum relationship with God prior to Nathan's death, you know, through his life. It was very much a growing relationship, but it was very immature. Through Nathan's illness, I certainly learned a greater trust and dependence on God. But it really happened after Nathan died. Nathan's death literally shattered my heart. I was down for the count. Didn't want to get back up. But in getting back up, God put my heart back together. There came a point in time where I felt God was asking me, you know, what is it that you want from me? And I thought long and hard about that before I, you know, just blurted something out. But I came to the place where I asked God for intimacy. I asked him for the ability to have a heart that could be intimate with him, with my husband, my daughter, with people, because I didn't have that kind of a heart. I didn't know what it was to truly be intimate in relationship. And so God, I cannot tell you how he has answered that prayer and given me intimacy with him, my Heavenly Father, and then given me intimacy with the people that I have in my life. It has been just a transformed heart. It's amazing to me. I didn't even like people. Before my mom died, I wanted to be an accountant because I didn't like people. And now I love people. My heart has such a capacity to love, and to be loved. It's amazing. It's just amazing how he has transformed my heart.
Yeah, I've heard you say before that if you could go back and have a choice of having Nathan or having the personal growth, the spiritual growth that you have now, you would choose now where you've come.
I would. God, I was spending time with the Lord and having my morning coffee, and I felt God asking me if I could, would I have Nathan back? But it would mean giving up everything that I had come to know of him and giving up who I had become in Christ. And without missing a beat, I heard myself say, no, Lord, I would not have him back. Of course, then the mother guilt kicked in, and you know, I feel like a terrible mother for saying that, but that is genuinely true. On the front end, I would never have chosen for my son to die.
Sure.
But with where I'm at now and seeing how God has worked in and through that in my own life and in the lives of so many others, I would not undo that. I would not undo that part of my history. I wouldn't undo any part of my history on this side because I have seen how God has worked in those circumstances.
I think so often we want to hit the delete button on the sad and difficult places in our lives. And while that's understandable, it's those very places that make us who we are. Teresa, what would you tell someone who's at the beginning of this most difficult journey of losing a child?
I think for me and for those that I work with, I think the best thing that someone can do for them is to encourage them that what they're feeling is normal. That it's normal to feel overwhelmed, it's normal to feel angry, it's normal to be tired and confused, just to validate that where they're at and what they're going through is normal. And then I think they really need to find a place or a person or a couple of persons that can walk it out with them. When you lose a child, it is one of the most devastating things that you'll ever go through. So that is where I begin with people, is just validating and then encouraging them to get connected with someone, whether it's a counselor, a friend, a pastor, to walk it through with them, because it is a tough and a long journey.
Right. So normalizing is important. Are there any good support groups that you could recommend, and when is the right time for that, do you think?
Well, there are certainly good support groups. I know in my search, I went to some secular support groups, and I also went to some church-based support groups. For me, the church-based support groups, that was what worked for me, because I knew that I needed God to be part, even though I was angry with him. I knew that he had to be part of my healing process. And really, it's just a thing of trial and error. There's no universal support group where, you know, wherever a person is located that you can go to that one. Compassionate Friends is one that deals with parents who have lost children, but sometimes even those groups are hard to find depending on where you're living. And so it really is a thing of asking and seeking and going and trying. And sometimes it may take you one, two, or even three tries with a support group before you can find one that fits for you. I know that was true in my case, but I kept at it until I could find something that fit me and worked for me. I certainly have established a new normal in life, and I have a very good life. It's filled with joy, but there is a very definite void with Nathan not being here.
Well, yours is certainly a story of hope and redemption. We're out of time for today. I'd like you to tell folks how they can get a copy of your book, Nathan, Still a Gift from God, and how they can contact you.
Okay. I self-published, and so they need to contact me. They can do that by phone, 540-487-4619, or they can do that by email, Isaiah61, and that's the numbers, 61, at intelos.net.
Teresa, thank you so much. Be sure to tune in next week for the second half of my interview with Teresa Sowers. God bless.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.